Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Friday's USDA twice yearly cattle inventory report has more minus signs in it than my checking account.
Well, we are still in contractionary mode.
Just like my bank account. That's USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagham there, and he says nothing in this new cattle report even suggests a turnaround in the continued beef herd reduction. For example,
the number of heifers being retained for beef cow replacement was down 2%. The number of beef cows in actuality was down 3%. So again, it's a smaller pool of breeding stock as of July 1st. Which is definitely an indication of a delay in the expansion.
One reason for that delay?
We have very low levels of forage available for producers.
Even as pastures start to perk up after a long drought, Shagham says it's going to be the better part of a year before some of those lands will be able to support grazing. Gary Crawford, Washington.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So July in my household is a time for summer break, weekends at the pool, fireworks, and commemorating our nation's independence. We celebrate, we relax. Occasionally there's a disruption with an afternoon thunderstorm or maybe the inescapable yard work that comes with the season.
Summer Mersinger is a commissioner with the Commodity Futures Trading Commission at a recent CFTC Ag Advisory Committee meeting.
However, I found the only thing I have to do to kind of ruin that summertime bubble is to call home and talk to my father. And I'm always quickly reminded that the month of July was not always so fun and relaxing when I was growing up. So most recently, it was, I think, probably on Father's Day when I called home and talked to my dad. And I always say, how are things going? Weather always comes up. And the conversation felt like deja vu. Dad said, well, we're in the middle of a drought and we desperately need rain. He was worried about shortened growth cycles and crops drying out from the heat and wind before they reached maturity, threatening lower yields at best and leaving nothing to harvest at worst. So I gave him one of my typical responses to this conversation. Well, Dad, it's either a drought or a flood, right? And usually my dad will respond with more grumbling about his fields and crops and maybe next year will be better. But this time he said something a little different that surprised me. He said, no, it's really bad this year. And I know his conclusion was not based on science or data, but just on what he knows from farming for over 6 years. Now, after so many years working in Washington, I rarely take what someone tells me at face value and try to do a little more research on my own. So I did go to NOAA's drought monitor to kind of see how this drought compares to previous summers, days that were always hot and dry and rain was never in the forecast. And according to the website, January through May of 2023, those months were recorded as the driest in the state of South Dakota in 129 years. So what I found out based on my quick research is Dad was right. It is really bad. But the impacts of dry conditions go far beyond crop health and yields. As we've heard from previous AAC meetings, and I believe we'll talk about again today, is that these effects are up and down the supply chain, with low water levels complicating barge traffic and movement of grain to various ports for exporting, decreasing available grazing land for livestock, placing higher demand on feedstock like corn. The overall agriculture economy feels these impacts, and we see the effects on the broader economy as well. That's why the derivatives markets we regulate at the CFTC are critical during times of economic hardship. And our job as regulators is to ensure those markets function well in their role of providing sound price discovery and hedging tools.
Chairman of the CFTC is Rustin Binham.
With all of these challenges we're facing, you need every tool in your toolbox to manage risk. And the futures markets, given their history and given the role the CFTC has played with respect to agriculture and production agriculture more specifically, ensuring that these markets are here for you becomes one of our biggest priorities, if not our number one priority. The number two issue we're going to discuss is the Mississippi. We also had a conversation about this, obviously. A key artery for American agriculture and getting goods out of the Midwest to the Gulf and across the globe. We provide food and fiber to the rest of the world, and in ensuring we can continue to do that, we need to make sure our infrastructure, including our waterways, are working.
Rustin Benham's chairman of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We're not into the daily rough and tumble of helping people hedge or do this, but market wants us to have a unique perspective.
Kansas State grain economist Dr. Dan O'Brien.
For corn, the USDA's projection of 177.5 bushels per acre and 15.3 billion bushels of corn is, I'd say, about 20% likely of happening. And much more thinking that probably a 3 out of 5 chance of having yields instead of 177.5, given the problems we're seeing, about 2 bushels per acre lower. And you end up with about 15.15 billion bushel carryout and ending stocks instead of 2.2, 2.3 billion, more like 2.1, and prices a little bit higher than what the USDA projected. They projected about 4.8 and 5.0. By the time we've wrestled with the numbers, I think what I'm seeing is that the big jump in corn acres is going to make it pretty hard for us, unless we have corn yields 171, 173. It's going to be pretty hard for us to get below 2 billion bushels carryout. And that's a pretty important area. So if we're around 2 billion bushels, it puts a lid on our prices. So when those acres shifted to corn, it really changed that game. Those acres went to corn out of soybeans. Soybeans is the other side of the story. We're tight enough on acres that now, as we've reduced them about, I think, 4 million acres lower for soybeans, that the USDA kept the same projection of 52 bushels an acre that they'd had, but dropped the acres and ended up with an ending stocks projection of about 300 million bushels, which is not much. When we really got tight in the past, it was around 100, 150. Well, if we now have just anything like a 50.5 bushels per acre, or more like 49 bushels per acre with problems in the central and eastern corn belt that we're fearing, then we're getting down pretty close to 200 million carryout, which is pretty close. Stocks to use below 5%. Prices moving pretty strongly. So as much as this acreage issue really affected corn and kind of puts a lid on just how high by itself it can get, it really opened the door for a lot of volatility on soybeans. Last thing I'd say on those crops is farmers in South America are watching all these prices, and they see these great soybean prices that we've got, and they're going to be planting their crops not too long, about September, October, November, December. And it's thought right now that as they see corn doing just so-so price-wise, I mean, still very good, but so-so relative to soybeans, that will probably swing quite a few acres in South America over to soybeans. So for the American farmer, then his choice is, does he go right along with that flow, or does he say, hey, if South America is going to go great guns for beans next year, what do I do for soybeans and corn when I figure out my 2024 planting? So that's a big thing. I did also look at some numbers for wheat. I don't want to go too long here on that, but I guess the point on wheat is that I think the USDA has had a hard time projecting the right amount of U.S. wheat exports. So the numbers that they put out are like 725 million. You look at our numbers now, we're not going to hit the latest numbers. So I've taken basically the USDA's projections and been pretty conservative with what the exports are actually going to be. And with that, it puts more of a limiting, inhibiting figure on the prices. Polite way of saying, yeah, it hurts our prices, that we don't have exports. And so the big thing that we thought happened about 2 years ago, and all this started to go on in the Black Series, is that, hey, they're short. Ukraine's going to be short, and that business will come to the U.S. Well, it never has yet. And maybe that's currencies, a whole bunch of other issues. So I think until we see the week when the world says, hey, we don't have enough wheat over there to buy, and let's go start buying from the U.S., that's the day when we really start to see wheat prices take off all that much more. But that day hasn't come yet.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm Dr. Karen St. Germain, and I run Earth Science for NASA.
Well, you were here to talk to the first Women in Ag Tech live in-person meeting. And first of all, how did you feel like being here?
Well, it's an honor to be here for the inaugural event, and really energizing to see all of these women coming together, tackling challenges that we all face, that humanity faces, and doing it in a way that is inviting the next generation to roll up their sleeves and get involved with us.
Well, it's eye-opening for some to find out the role that NASA plays in agriculture. What are some of the main points that you hit on here with this, to tell them what you do as far as agriculture is concerned?
Well, you know, agriculture has been one of the oldest constituencies of NASA Earth. You know, we launched our first agriculture-focused satellite in the 70s amid a major food crisis, and that was the Landsat mission. But since then, we've really upped our game. We're observing not just the land and land change, but also precipitation, the global climate, and the way all of that is changing. And what we're hoping to do is give producers headlights, in fact, high beams, to see what's coming.
And you, I mean, you tend to, you work with a lot of agencies that producers know, but you work behind the scenes, and they may not know that your work is being used to give them information.
That's right. And we work with partners to amplify the impact of NASA science because, of course, we think the science itself is awesome. And it is. But it doesn't reach its full potential until it's out into the hands of people who can use it. And working with other government agencies or universities and extension programs, these are all partnerships that amplify the impact of our work.
Well, you are also here, while you're here, you're on a tour, and you're talking with a lot of ag groups and farmers even. So tell us about that.
Yeah, the idea is that we get together with commodity groups, individual farmers, university extension programs, and even some of the big tech companies to really understand how our work can help advance what they're doing. And you don't get that without spending some time in conversation, understanding what challenges they have, and talking through what we might be able to do to help, and then trying some things. So a lot of what I want to get out of this week is the ideas and the seeds for projects that we'll go try, because NASA's a science agency, but my favorite thing about NASA is we're a learning agency. We want to learn, and we want to help others learn.
How do you feel about a woman in technology? You talked about, you know, the percentages generally of women in the room and any particular role that you've played over the years. But how do you said you felt energized looking at this group here. But how do you feel about the role of women in technology in general going forward?
You know, I think the role of women in agriculture, in technology, in these critical undertakings, you can't overstate it. You can't overstate the importance of having women in the room. And that's because women bring a different perspective. They bring different questions. They bring different experience and expertise. And that's the key to excellence. You know, in my world, in science, the quality of the science is all about the quality of the questions you ask. And when we have diversity in our teams, when we have women at the table, we ask better questions.
Well, great to meet you here, Karen. Thank you very much here at the Tech Hub Live event in Des Moines. I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We are what's known as an independent introducing broker, an IIB.
Kurt Strubars with the Grain and Feed Association of Illinois. He was speaking recently at a CFTC Ag Advisory Committee hearing.
The other introducing broker entity is a guaranteed introducing broker, a GIB. And I'm sure most all of you are aware, a GIB is tied to a single FCM, has some capital guarantees, et cetera, compliance functions coming from that FCM. An independent introducing broker, IIB, like us, is not tied to a single FCM. We have our own capital requirements, our own compliance department. And point of that is a lot of our clients desire to have multiple FCM relationships through us as an IB. And that's always been the case, but it was accelerated 11 and 12 years ago with the failure of MF Global and PFG Best. That created a lot of need from our client base to say, hey, we can't be tied anymore to a single FCM. If there's a failure, you know, we need a backup. And credit the CFTC, some regulations have certainly tightened up, and we hope that there isn't another failure of those magnitudes. But those failures had a long tail, and the industry is still well aware, and internal risk management practices of our client base have led to that desire to have multiple relationships. So we have clients who desire, again, two or three FCM relationships. with a relatively smaller pool of FCMs that we can do that with. So it's a concern as we look at things going forward. That there are some very good FCMs out there, and I don't mean to say that at all. Jerry's firm, you know, is very focused on introducing broker type business, and full disclosure, we do have a relationship with RJ O'Brien as one of the FCMs that we do some business with. So there are good entities out there. It's just a shrinking number, and that's always a concern as we look at our business longer term. One of the things I wanted to note in response, or potentially in response to the shrinking number of FCMs, one could consider the direct clearing model, you know, which caught a lot of attention a year ago with FTX proposing that on the financial side of the business and a CME filing at that time to allow a direct clearing model, presumably in response to the FTX proposal. And we know that has not come to fruition. But from our client base, there's a lot of resistance to that model. The FCM provides a good spring in terms of capital risk, things like that, as opposed to directly clearing, particularly for the mid-size to smaller entity, you know, producers, ranchers, smaller grain trading companies. The FCM world, again, provides a good spring in terms of risk management there. And the particular direct clearing model that FTX had proposed included, of course, that the auto liquidation model as means of a margin risk management process. From a hedging perspective, that's very difficult to put in place. From a speculative standpoint, that certainly would have some merit. But from a hedging perspective, if one's hedges start to get auto liquidated because of an intraday margin issue, then one is out of position relative to the underlying cash grain position, which is not desirable at all. And to over margin an account to compensate for that has obviously a lot of capital cost, financing cost, et cetera. So we're strong advocates for the FCM model as opposed to a direct clearing model in that regard. So maybe the final comment I would make, I understand that this is all economics for the most part, as opposed to a regulatory type issue. We do regularly get approached by different entities to potentially form a new FCM, you know, a client focused, a smaller entity focused type FCM. And if the economics justified that, we would certainly go in that direction. It would really change the capital model for us. It would likely mean a little less efficiency for the farmer, rancher, mid-sized to smaller grain trading company, et cetera. But we would get there if the economics justified that.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So this is our biannual report. We get a snapshot of cattle inventories in the U.S. twice a year as of January 1, and this one is as of July 1.
Iowa State livestock economist Lee Schultz.
This mid-year report is just national. So in January, we get state-level inventories. The one in July, it's just national. So, you know, we're looking at things in aggregate. And really, they came within pre-report expectations. The headline numbers we're always looking at here are the beef cow numbers. So those were down 2.6% compared to a year ago and really close to pre-report expectations. You know, if there was maybe a bit of a surprise, heifers for replacement number was down 2.4%. Pre-report expected it down even more. So, you know, I think there's still a lot of, I think, uncertainty about the number of heifers that are going into feedlots, the number that are going to be held back for replacement. And so, you know, we're going to digest some of these numbers over the coming weeks and months to really see what that level of herd replacement is. But generally, it shows us the same story here, that herd contractions continuing. You know, as you look at the beef cow herd and the slaughter of beef cows we've had through 27 weeks here in 2023, we've culled 6.2% of the national herd. That's the second highest culling percent ever compared to last year. So last year was 6.88%. So you have to go back to 1986 is when we have the data available. We've never culled this large a percentage. Only last year was larger. So, you know, that gives us a strong indication that we're still in a large contractionary phase in this cattle inventory cycle. You know, when you look at feeder cattle outside feedlots, that was down 3.6%. So what does that mean? Very tight feeder cattle supply is coming ahead, right? So we've seen strength in the feeder cattle market. That's really expected to continue. The calf crop was down almost 2%. So again, indication that we're seeing tight supplies for several more years now until we see some herd rebuilding. One quick calculation that you can make in this cattle inventory report and looking at the cattle on feed report is the number of cattle in feedlots with less than 1,000 head capacity. So you compare the cattle inventory, which is all cattle on feed, the cattle on feed report, which is 1,000+ head feed yards. And what it shows is the number of cattle in small feedlots is actually down 5%. Number in larger feedlots is only down 1.8%. So I think, you know, it gives an indication here that with these really strong feeder cattle prices, maybe that has tempered some enthusiasm in some smaller farmer feeders. When you look at, you know, placement costs, especially with relatively high feed costs as well, and what those placements would require.
How does a report like this impact the markets?
When you look at the cattle inventory report, you know, this report is really going to impact markets medium to long term, right? So they're not short term alterations or possible for those in the markets. Because here, you know, we're talking about an inventory at a point in time. You know, if we look at reports that can impact markets, you know, cattle on feed certainly a little bit more. But as I, you know, talk through that report, I think it is relatively neutral, maybe a tone of bearishness, but I don't see that really playing out in the marketplace. So, you know, the cattle inventory report here, I think, points to continued herd contraction. Again, we'll get another update in January, but, you know, we're looking at likely the low in those inventory numbers in 2024, 2025 yet. So, you know, continue to monitor the situation, but all signs point to, you know, very strong prices going forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
My name is Scott Cogdill. I'm the Director of Business Development with ProAgrica.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about ProAgrica and maybe something about the history of the company?
Yeah, so, you know, we're basically a tech company involved in agriculture. I mean, obviously, as we all are for Tech Hub. You know, when we look at our mission statement is connecting agronomic and business data across the agricultural supply chain, enabling our customers to achieve more with less. I mean, and that's a, you know, pretty sweeping statement. A lot of that is through, you know, software workflow solutions, whether that be data standards, data networks for B2B transactions, or even, you know, things like CDMS with, you know, data content standards, rules engines, you know, very large sweeping kind of across multiple continents. You know, been a company now is one for about 5-6 years total, had some acquisitions along the way, especially with like CDMS here in the last couple of years. But, you know, really is part of RELX, you know, a data and data standards and a security company, you know, based out of London. That plays in many, you know, in many industries and many scenarios within different markets. But historically, you know, we're through a series of acquisitions that have brought us together as one.
What's new this year with ProAgrica? I know we talked last year at Tech Hub Live, but what's new and different with ProAgrica this year?
Yeah, I mean, really, a lot of our focus right now has been about, you know, especially within our Ag Solutions products. It's about modernizing, you know, really moving more of the workflows to some different web environments across both Cirrus and our, you know, Gatekeeper products. You know, one of the big ones as well, some announcements that came out is, you know, a global reach of CDMS content data and just CDMS services being offered globally. But a lot of it is really, you know, just more about, you know, focusing, you know, within the markets and the customers that we serve. You know, and modernizing, making things better, just getting more efficient and just really trying to focus on, like I said, the customers and the markets that we serve and just getting better at what we do within those.
Well, we're talking about the third annual Tech Hub Live coming up and ProAgrica, once again, a partner of Tech Hub Live and specifically the networking partner. So why is being a part of this conference and specifically being the networking partner important to ProAgrica?
Yeah, I mean, for, you know, for us, we work across so many sectors of ag tech, whether that be ag retailers to, you know, manufacturers to OEM equipment manufacturers, to tech companies, you know, our partners, competitors, you know, that we still have great relationships with. So for us, when you really look at it, you know, we really want to be as part of the, you know, the greater industry network across the greater industry because we do offer services, solutions, support tools, whatever that may end up being for so many areas of agriculture that, you know, being a part of a conference like this, especially sponsoring the networking side, just kind of fits upon how we go across the market, or how we go to the market, where we feel our fit within the market is. And just kind of, you know, we preach the idea of working together, expanding the market, expanding services, collaboration for the betterment of the market. So what better way than to do the networking sponsorship for a conference like this?
All right. Thank you very much, Scott. I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
Thanks, Cindy. And this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Monday is the start day of a follow-up to a 2021 United Nations Food Systems Summit. Agriculture Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs Jenny Moffitt leads the U.S. delegation in Rome for the UN Food Systems Summit Plus Two Stocktaking Moment.
In 2021, at the inaugural summit, we all charted out and made plans of what we would like to do, and this is a chance for us to all reflect on what we've done.
The three-day summit, looking to build more sustainable and resilient food systems globally, includes the Undersecretary's participation as a speaker in sessions ranging from school meals to innovations through science and technology. She adds,
I'm really looking forward to coming there with curiosity. I'm looking forward to listening and hearing what other countries are doing, and so that we can bring that back to the United States and think about how we can continue the work that we're doing with new frames of mind.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.